Welcome to Rapid Reaction, the shorter version of the Reaction podcast. I'm Ian Martin, editor of Reaction, and I'm joined by Maggie Pagano, executive editor of Reaction. We're talking Scotland, lots to talk about, a lot happening, and possibly towards the end we'll have time to discuss the latest flags row. Maggie?
You were very sceptical that Sturgeon would be under pressure. You thought she'd survive it all. How do you feel now after the events of this week? First of all, David Davis's extraordinary speech from the with the complaints from the whistleblower in the House of Commons, and then the supposed report result of the report from Holyrood, which is pretty damning. How do you feel now? Do you still think that she's safe?
Well, I did say on our most recent episode of the podcast that I'm very, very bad at predicting precisely when politicians are going to resign. I often think they'll cling on and then they don't. It is getting more and more difficult for her. I mean, it's not when I say that she's safe, I don't necessarily think that she should be. I think it is appalling the way in which the SNP have centralized power and then abused that power. So I think she has really serious questions to answer. I just don't think that it's in her nature to resign. And the logic of the way in which they've handled everything throughout this episode, throughout this inquiry, is to push it back as far as possible, close to the election. Now, why does that matter? Because if you could get it to about now, and the Scottish Parliament is about to go into purdah, remember, you're also about to go into an election period, then you can say, as Nicola Sturgeon is saying this week, look, it's the end of the Parliament now anyway, so there's almost no point resigning. I will let the Scottish people, the Scottish electorate, or the half of them that will vote in the Scottish Parliament election, they will be judge and jury, and they'll decide who they believe on who misled Parliament and whether that matters or not. So I think it was quite deliberate strategy to sort of run down the clock. She is now, though, increasingly in a difficult position, because just by the clever way in which her enemies have played this on the committee, and the leak, deliberately, I think, leaked to try and stop Sturgeon shutting down the story next week. Because remember, the committee is publishing its report next week. But then also the other thing which could actually, which will probably decide her fate, is the publication of the report by James Hamilton QC, the Irish QC, who's drafted in to investigate whether she did break the ministerial code. And we'll come to that in a second. That's all happening this weekend. And the report is being written this weekend by Hamilton, I understand, or completed this weekend, and he's actually interviewing. It's with speaking on Friday afternoon. He's, as I understand it, interviewing Alex Salmond this afternoon, on Friday afternoon, and will then complete his report. So that will, I think, ultimately decide her fate on this. But the leak from the committee, which suggests that they've concluded that she misled Parliament, which could point to her having broken the ministerial code, provoked a furious reaction from Sturgeon. But it's an attempt by the committee, or the majority of the committee, those driving the committee, to take control of the story and prevent Sturgeon from shutting it down. So I think it's now more likely than it was that this could do for her in some way.
Two questions there. Isn't that a rather dangerous strategy, sort of saying, let the public decide? It rather sort of proves the point that a lot of critics have made, that, you know, the Scottish Parliament doesn't have any legs, and it doesn't have strong enough powers. So that could work, that could backfire on her as well, couldn't it? Secondly, which do we know which will come first, Hamilton's report or the result of the committee? Because
it's not quite clear. I've seen it reported that it would be on the same day, that Tuesday could be the the big defining day. I'm not sure precisely what Hamilton's timings are, but it is all coming to a head early next week. And I think you make a good point about how it could backfire. In a way, she doesn't have any other option. I mean, it's just kind of all she's got left to say, which is let the voters decide. The polling on this is interesting. I think there is a trend too much in politics now to look at obsessively at the polling. But this is a case where I think it's surprising. When you poll Scottish voters, Nicola Sturgeon is popular because of her handling of the pandemic and has relatively high or very high approval ratings on that basis. But the polls that have been done in recent weeks and months, when you ask, should she resign if she has either misled Parliament or broken the ministerial code, an overwhelming or large significant majority of Scots think that she should. Now, what's that about? I think that is about punters, voters, having a pretty clear, even if they don't understand every aspect of the case, because the story is kind of interminable, they can understand that it in terms of someone having broken the rules at work and being a breach of trust. Now, in those circumstances, she's going into an election which the SNP was, remember, a few months ago, very confident of smashing it and winning a substantial majority, which is quite difficult within that system. But they had such an enormous lead. It's now an election potentially of quite fine margins. And if she, even as we've said on this podcast several times, even a difference of 2, 3, 4, 5 points could make a massive difference on the number of seats. So if she goes into the campaign under pressure on the basis that you describe, and that ends up costing her even just a few points, and she falls short of a majority, then after all of that, after the pandemic, after all of the party's clamour for a second referendum, and she doesn't win a majority, then she's failed. I mean, I was going to ask you, Maggie, what you make of the story, because it is, and I had a hilarious call from a well established English journalist this afternoon, asking me from another publication, just confessing that he was completely baffled by the whole thing, that he felt as though he'd landed, as he put it, in series 3 of The Wire, not having seen the first two, and couldn't make head nor tail of this arcane sort of Caledonian mad story. What do you make of it?
Oh, I just find it absolutely gripping, and have done really ever since it sort of started unraveling. And what I feel is we've got all the technical things, the reports, whether she misled or not. And clearly the Scottish people are quite conservative, because I suspect that they won't like the fact that if she has broken the law and thinks she should go. But most of all, I think that when politicians get this sort of bad smell around them, it's sort of like tar, and then the feathers will stick. I sort of feel that her position is untenable, actually. It's there's so many questions about how and what she said, and David Davis's the claims that were made via his statement, that there was pressure on complainants from within the Scottish. I mean, it's sort of unbelievable, actually. But yet, when you look at her and this way that she's run the country with such an iron fist for so long, actually, it's sort of like, what's the word I want? It's when you try and do something, it's poetic justice that she will unravel because of her own attempt to cling to power.
Yeah.
So it's
the denouement, as we've discussed before, of a 25-year story, which is Salmond's project. Well, Salmond became leader in 1990, but once he got established properly after the 92 election, and started to build in the mid 90s. And Sturgeon was one of the young stars identified by Salmond as the future of the party. And it's a very small group of people, many of them now rent asunder by this crisis on different sides of the great divide between Sturgeon and Salmond. And Salmond built this highly centralized model. Mm. Sometimes I think have to do in politics is sort of pursuing something that's a 20, 30 year mission and regarding and requiring complete loyalty, small group who lived in each other's pockets. And that now is all blown apart. And that centralized command and control structure, in Salmond's terms, I'm sure he's now horrified that he sees that having been turned against him in the story of the last 4 or 5 years. But also the problem that the SNP has now is that story is about Salmond and Sturgeon, and there isn't a successor generation. That's why I think ultimately she's clinging on, as well as pride, and she's a very a very dogged, determined individual. There isn't a successor. The only the sort of stand-in caretaker would be John Swinney, who was a disaster as SNP leader in the early 2000s when Salmond first stood down, and then he had to resign and Salmond had to come back and Sturgeon was his deputy. She had at that point, of course, been the assumed successor but was about to lose. So when you're winding to the end of a 25-year story without a successor generation, so it's all rather fragile, which is why I mean there'll be some unionists listening to this saying that that this is all hopelessly optimistic because actually she'll stick this out, she'll probably win the election, and then she carries on. But I want, even if she does win the election, I wonder for how much longer it has a fin de siècle, end of days.
Yeah.
Feel about it, no matter what the outcome is.
Yeah, I totally agree. And isn't that a dreadful indictment, actually, of both of them, or of their rule, if you like, that there is no young successor? There is, we mentioned this before, I did, other than independence, there's no sort of political philosophy there that people are clinging to or can put out. And does that, just quickly, Ian, it's intriguing that Anna Sawa, the Labour leader, is standing at the election against her in her seat. Now, I know, and you've told me, I mean, she got a huge majority, but even so, he's going to be high-risk gamble for him, but also he can have a lot of fun, can't he? Not just with her record on this sexual harassment, but on the schools, on the NHS, on the deprivation, because I think her constituency also has a very high level of poverty. So it's going to be maybe she'll lose a seat before she would.
Yeah, I mean, it seems so this is the bit that we cut out when the most bizarre political story of the year happens and she loses her seat in the Holyrood elections. This is the bit we cut out and say, well, I was completely wrong. I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, in numerical terms, her majority's not enormous because remember the turnout's low and turnouts for Holyrood are low and they're low in that seat. But she, I think last time, I think I'm right in saying got 64% of the vote. So people who get more than 50% of the vote, only in the most bizarre circumstances could you imagine them then losing the seat. So something really weird would have to happen, an enormous surge of turnout for it pretty much all to go to the Labour Party. And Sawa, who's a really interesting individual and potentially could do something very constructive with the Scottish Labour Party, has only been in office for a few weeks and hasn't really had that much time to cut through. So I would be surprised. It's a great story. And as you say, the record on the ground is a very, very deprived seat, but I'd be surprised if she actually lost. On the question of the successor generation, I mean, I don't think that's unique to the SNP. That quite often happens with political projects like the Blairite project. It didn't create a successor generation, and the two main figures at the heart of it, Blair and Brown, not quite as spectacularly as Sturgeon and Salmon, but they did end up falling out.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a successor generation. It may be a function of how when you have that group of politically motivated, highly dedicated, small group of men and women who have a project which is taking over a party and taking it to power, it's all about the people at the heart of the project, and the succession question by definition doesn't get thought about, because that would indicate weakness, and sustaining a group like that is all about the willing to suspension of disbelief. So you have to believe in their power. But I know I've probably mentioned it before, but it is one of the most bizarre aspects of the SNP's achievement that this has endured for so long, and that this is the, as I say, the denouement of a 25-year story.
Mm.
When this was getting going, and when Salmond was plotting a path to using devolution as a stepping stone to full independence and working out the strategy for that in the mid-1990s, John Major was prime minister.
Wow. Yes.
And look how many leaders the Tory party's had since. Tony Blair was just the newly elected leader of the Labour Party, and that small group of people were so dedicated, and they came very close in 2014 to breaking up the British state, and may come close to it again.
Is there any way Salmond could come back in and take control, or isn't there any one of his yes men within the party?
It's unlikely that Salmond himself, considering everything that's happened, could come back. It's not likely, is it, that Scottish women particularly will be clamouring to vote for Alex Salmond after everything that's happened in the last few years. So I don't know. I'm told by people who know him that he accepts that, and is very worried about what's happened to Scotland under the SNP and its use of arbitrary authority and abuse of power, and I'm told sees his role in terms of influence, not quite kingmaker, but influence in terms of who becomes next leader. I mean, obviously, he's close to someone like Joanna Cherry, who's very very talented lawyer, Salmond. Loyalist, opposed by the Sturgeon forces. So I think that's how he would see his influence, as being someone who could help shape things behind the scenes post Sturgeon, and once Sturgeon goes, whether that's now or in a couple of years' time. Mm-hmm. The other thing we were going to talk about briefly, Maggie, was the flags thing, which I tweeted a few things about it and then wished I hadn't. This is the BBC presenter who got into hot water on the question of the Union flag and pictures of the Queen. And it seemed to me to raise pertinent questions about identity and about how much the country is changing in the way in which, as Robert Shrimsley of the FT put it, ultra-liberal Britain or England doesn't realise the extent to which it's losing this argument, and politics is shifting, and the way in which she expressed it, and of course she then had to subsequently effectively apologise, was another example of ultra-liberal metropolitan, for want of a better term, London, England, missing the point of what's happening. How did you see it?
I have to say, I didn't like the way she sniggered. I thought that was really rather mean. and sort of unnecessary. She should have been able to control herself. But I thought the fact that she was asked by the BBC to then delete those tweets, I thought that was silly, because actually, because of the whole, you know, I don't have to go through all the arguments. She should be able to say what she likes. And okay, I take the point that they should be impartial, but actually, I'd rather know what she really thinks. Because then you can make a view, you know, in a sense, where your presenters are coming from. But I think the broader issue is, why do we have such a sort of ambiguous relationship with our flag? It's not something that Nicola Sturgeon has a problem with, because she flies the Saltire, am I correct, all the time. You know, but somehow when the British fly it, it's seen as representing some sort of lunatic Saint George, you know, all. It's very curious, isn't it? I mean, if you went to, I don't know if you've ever been to Norway, but if you travel around the country, every home has its flagpole in the garden. And you should go there on May the 17th on their National Independence Day, and everybody is dressed up and you wave flags. You put flags on your Christmas tree, actually. But that's seen as traditional and patriotic. But as nationalist in the way that we perceive it. So why do you think we have this problem?
Yeah, I mean, you said nationalism and patriotism. I do think they're not the same thing, are they? One of the persistent features of the last 5-6 years and the period around Brexit has been the way in which liberal left opinion has deliberately or not has confused those two things. Hmm. I mean, it's not someone like Italy. You know, I remember talking to an Italian academic a few years ago about precisely this: why is it that the Brits have this argument, and why is that a large part of its intelligentsia cannot see that patriotism is a positive force, nationalism isn't. And they're not, then to elide the two, to confuse the two, if you're in politics or you're in the public sphere, you're asking for a kicking from the voters, which then Julie keeps happening in Britain. The liberal left, the liberal left keeps losing and gets more and more angry about it. I have a split personality on this, because I think the reason. You know, I like that. I like the fact that the patriotic argument is winning, and I know there'll be people listening to this who will think that that's a criticism, or this is not a question of remain or leave. That's not the point I'm making at all. Mm. I just mean that the majority of people really quite like the country.
Yeah,
quite like Britain. It has many flaws, but it's not a terrible place. It's actually a rather fantastic place to live, with a hell of a lot going, for it. And that is a widely held view in the country. So there isn't a path to a majority that involves not liking the country, or thinking it's a, what is it, Emma Thompson described it as, a sort of miserable gray cake filled little island lost off, perched off the end of Europe. There are some Liberal Democrat votes in that, but there aren't sufficient votes to build a winning political.
Simply not true. Has she been to the Lake District or the North?
Exactly. but just on the flag point. But I think some of the reaction of the anti-woke forces. Fascinating watching the anti-woke forces now start to mimic the behaviour of woke forces. The same, so it seems to me destructive ultimately to fight offence archaeology with offence archaeology. Yeah. You know, so someone must apologise for liking some tweets. I mean, I like tweets, and lots of people do, that I don't necessarily agree with, but I just think they're noteworthy, and it's quicker than bookmarking them. But of course, she then has to issue this grovelling statement. It's also, I just think, a bit kind of, you know, undignified and vulgar. But the question on the flag thing, Gordon Brown always used to ask this question when he was doing his look, I'm so British and the left need to reclaim British patriotism shtick, which he's always been very interested in. And he made that a feature of his early months as prime minister. And I remember him saying this and having a discussion with him about it at a dinner, that it's more complicated than that in Britain. We have a more complex relationship with the Union flag. Obviously, I like seeing it and approve of it, but we have more than one flag in this country. Mm. So the process of trying to figure out where the flag of St. George sits in all of this, where the Scots, where the saltire is, which unionists feel they own as much as nationalists, and can display in certain circumstances the saltire and in others the Union flag. I mean, Sturgeon obviously has a problem with the Union flag, isn't it? She wants to take Scotland out of the Union. And then the other complicating factor is that the Brits tend to be undemonstrative and tend to have a slight cynicism or skepticism of too much flag waving. Yeah. The Olympics is a different case, yeah, for reasons we all understand, and that was a joyous moment. So I don't, when I see some people shouting at a BBC presenter about this, and I think she was joking. I think it's more complex and interesting than the stupid row on Twitter.
And it's rather sweet, that sort of British reserve about not wanting to show off and wave the flag. It's rather nice. I think it's one of the strengths of the country, oddly enough. But I have to say, if I were Robert Jenrick, I would go and get myself a suit made in the British flag. And next time he appears on TV, he should sit there, one of those silly bowler hats, and just show that it's a joke, you know, have a laugh about it. And then Naga can tweet that as well.
Yeah, because it's interesting. I tweeted sort of in support of her. We follow each other on Twitter. I just thought there was something really bullying about the campaign to get her to unlike, if that's the phrase, those tweets. And then people started shouting at me saying, that's not why we're annoyed with her. It's because she was dismissive of the flag, which, you know, maybe she was. I, watching back the clip, I thought she was just trying to be a bit, a bit sort of flippant and make a point about the fact that it was so bloody obvious that a PR person had said, look, yep, just left a bit, and then we can see the Queen on the wall, and then you've got the flag in view, you've got the Queen and the flag, perfect. And I thought it was an observation about that, but then I was surprised to get a text from an esteemed subscriber of Reaction who told me no, I was completely wrong, and that her attitude had been a classic of the kind that we were referring to earlier, just sort of sniffy about the flag and missing the point. I do think, though, it goes, and that's where Robert Shrimsley of the FT, I think, is completely on the money on this, is that it illustrates how much post-Brexit British politics, or rather English politics, is changing, which stores up big problems for the Union potentially longer term, as the Conservative Party is becoming much more the English Party, and it's a working class, not exclusively working class, obviously, but more working class, English, patriotic, collectivist, actually, and sometimes within it, sometimes with a tendency towards authoritarianism, rather than liberty and notions of liberty and freedom. And that's the way in which English politics is going. And it is very difficult to see the gap then, barring some massive economic crisis in the next 10 years, for Labour to win. Where does it, you know, if Boris and the Tories build that coalition of about 45% of the country, which sees England, the flag, liking the country as a sort of prime motivating forces in politics, how the hell does the Labour Party get to 40 to 45%?
What do they say? Governments don't win elections, they lose them.
Possibly.
Events. Sorry, lots of cliches here, but, you know, there'll be something coming down the road. Sturgeon might go, and then the union actually gets strong. Scottish Labour reinvigorates.
Yeah.
Red Wall. I mean, the challenge for Boris is to actually do what they've said, move business, investment and so forth into the regions, isn't it?
I think we should wrap things up there, because we did term this a rapid reaction podcast, and we've ended up talking for 30 minutes rather than 15 minutes, and we are as we're getting back to doing more podcasts and lots of other interesting exciting things happening, we're testing out some formats. So if you're a reaction subscriber and you're listening to this, let us know whether 15 minutes or half an hour is good for you, or the we do the longer format as well. But thank you for joining us. If you are listening to this and you're not a reaction subscriber, go to the website. It's really easy to become a subscriber. We begin our free bottle of gin offer on Monday, so that's a bottle of fantastic gin. Details on the site on Monday when you sign up with an annual membership. And thank you very much for listening, and until next time, thank you.